Welcome to The End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. Last week, we continued our series that we are calling The Hills to Die On regarding the JFK assassination. A hill to die on refers to a cause, belief, or position someone is so strongly committed to that they are willing to fight for it to the very end, even if it means facing significant consequences or defeat. Essentially, it's an issue someone considers so important they are prepared to stand their ground no matter what. One of the biggest hills that I choose to die on in this case is the fact that we know with absolute certainty that there was someone impersonating Lee Harvey Oswald for weeks or possibly months leading up to the assassination. There is not a single doubt in my mind that someone was impersonating Lee Harvey Oswald and setting up a narrative for him for some time before the assassination. I found during my research that many of the sightings of a second Oswald was seen by multiple witnesses. This was not just some random person who resembled Oswald. In most instances, witnesses reported that the man they identified as Lee Harvey Oswald provided specific details about Oswald's life, such as his family and his past, that made it clear he wanted people to believe he was Oswald, even if he wasn't the real one. The question I have is, why was someone doing this, and who was doing this? Think about it for a minute. These impersonations were done for a reason. These took a lot of time, effort, and money. This was not someone out doing it for fun. And why would you impersonate Lee Harvey Oswald anyway? This person that wanted people to think he was Oswald was seen at the gun range several times, a furniture store, a car dealership, applying for a job at a couple of radio stations around the Dallas area. He also spoke with Laura Cottrell at the Texas Employment Commission, trying to convince her that he was Lee Harvey Oswald, when she knew it wasn't the real Lee Oswald, because she had spoken to him on several occasions. This person also applied for a job at the Hill Machinery Company and put down the name Oswald on his application, and his Marine service was also listed on the form.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
In some recent episodes, we looked at impersonations of Lee Harvey Oswald for weeks and months before the assassination. We heard about sightings of two Oswalds in Dallas just a couple days before the assassination, on a city bus, at the Dobbs House restaurant, and then we heard the incredible and sad story of Ralph Leon Yates as he picked up the Oswald double on Wednesday, November 20th, giving him a ride to the corner of Elm and Houston, which happens to be the location of the Texas School Book Depository building. These are just a few places that the person was seen impersonating Lee Harvey Oswald, when we know for a fact that the real Lee Harvey Oswald was present at other places during these times. In episode 89, we looked at the sightings of the Oswald double on the day of the assassination, possibly in Dealey Plaza, the site of the J.D. Tippit shooting, the Texas Theater, and in an El Chico parking lot at about 2 p.m. on the day of the assassination, after the real Lee Harvey Oswald had already been arrested and in police custody. Conveniently, this El Chico parking lot where the second Oswald was last seen by T.F. White in Dallas was only about a block away from the Texas Theater. In last week's episode, we heard the incredible story of a former U.S. Air Force Sergeant, Robert Vinson, who claimed to have witnessed an interesting event on the day of the Kennedy assassination. The interlocking testimonies of Sergeant Vinson and numerous others that we have spoken about in recent episodes may have given us a backstage view of the double Oswald drama directed by the CIA in the Oak Cliff section of Dallas on November 22, 1963. Their stories fit too easily and make too much sense for there not to be nothing there. According to Robert Vinson, he traveled by bus on the morning of November 22, 1963, from Washington, D.C. to the nearby Andrews Air Force Base, with the intention of hitching a ride on an Air Force plane to Ant Air Force Base in Colorado Springs, Colorado. He was told that the only available flight was on a cargo plane heading to Lowry Air Force Base in Denver, about 50 miles north of Colorado Springs. He and two pilots were the only people on the plane, which lacked the usual Air Force markings. Its only identification was on its tail, a rust-brown graphic of an egg-shaped Earth crossed by white grid marks. At some point during the flight, the pilot announced over the intercom that, quote, the president was shot at 12:29 p.m., end quote. The plane then immediately turned and headed south. At about 3:30 p.m., Vincent recognized the city of Dallas. The plane landed on a rough patch of land close to the Trinity River, between downtown Dallas and the Oak Cliff section of Dallas. This is the section of Dallas where the real Lee Harvey Oswald lived, and J.D. Tippit was shot and killed, and Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested in the Texas Theater. All of this occurred in the Oak Cliff section of Dallas. With the plane's engine still running, two men in beige overalls got on board, not speaking to each other or acknowledging Vincent's presence. The plane then quickly took off again and landed shortly after dusk on a proper runway. The two passengers and the two pilots all rapidly left the plane. Vincent, alone, made his way to a building, where he was told to his surprise that he had landed not in Denver, but at Roswell Air Force Base in New Mexico. He made his way to Colorado Springs the next day. Watching the television coverage of the assassination, he was struck by the remarkable resemblance between Lee Harvey Oswald and one of the two men who had got on the plane in Dallas. His wife Roberta encouraged him to keep quiet about what he had seen for his own safety. About a year later, Robert Vincent was summoned back to Washington, D.C., and from there to CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. He spent 5 days there, undergoing psychological and physical tests, after which he was formally invited to join the CIA. He would decline the offer. Early in 1965, the Air Force did not ask Vincent, but told him that he would be working in an administrative role for the CIA at a secret base north of Las Vegas. At the base, he discovered other planes which contained the same unusual markings as the plane he had taken on that day of the assassination. Vincent believed he was forced to take the job with the CIA so they could keep an eye on him. After a year and a half working for the CIA, Robert Vincent retired. For nearly 30 years, he told very few people about his experiences on the day of the Kennedy assassination. After the passage of the JFK Records Act in 1992, Vincent consulted his congressional representative, who informed him that he was now free from any restrictions imposed by his former employment. In 1993, Vincent gave an interview to a local Wichita, Kansas television station. The ensuing publicity brought him to the attention of a local lawyer, James Johnson, who cooperated with journalist John Rowe on the 2003 book titled Flight from Dallas, New Evidence of CIA Involvement in the Murder of President John F. Kennedy. In 2008, author and investigative journalist James Douglas did exactly what we have done on this podcast the last several episodes. He takes Robert Vincent's account and places it next to those of several other witnesses to form a consistent narrative of events immediately after the assassination. He would release a book in 2008 titled JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. I sat down with Robert Vincent in his home in Wichita, Kansas in January of 1998, and he shared with me his story. I put Robert Vincent in the same class as I would Ed Hoffman, whom I spent a lot of time with. A very good and honorable man that saw something he was not supposed to see on that afternoon in 63. And for many years, he was too scared to go on record with what he had saw. While both men told others around them immediately after the assassination what they saw, they were both told to keep quiet for their own safety and the safety of their family. This week, we're going to hear part one of a two-part interview that was done with Robert Vincent himself back on November 2nd, 1996. It is the first time Vincent would allow anyone to record his statement about his life and what he witnessed on November 22, 1963. This is a very historic interview that doesn't get the attention it deserves because many people discount Vincent's story. I'm not one of those people. Here's part one of the interview.
My name is James P. Johnston. I'm an attorney practicing law in Wichita, Kansas. Today's date is November 2, 1996. I have with me today Mr. Robert G. Vincent, my client, who is here at my request to give us a statement concerning the events of November 22, 1963, both prior to that date, on that date, and subsequent to that date. Mr. Vincent, would you please, first of all, give us your full name?
My name is Robert Greel Vincent.
Mr. Vincent, first of all, what has been your occupation during most of your life?
I was in the Air Force for 20 years, starting in 1946.
Now, in your military career, Mr. Vinson, have you received any particular awards which might be considered important from the standpoint of your military duty and ability?
Yes, I received the Air Force Commendation Medal and the Joint Army and Air Force Commendation Medal, which is a highly recognized medal in the armed services.
All right. Now, Mr. Vinson, of course, you received an honorable discharge from the service, is that correct?
Yes.
And that would have been from the Air Force?
From the Air Force.
All right. Do you also have a pilot's license, or did you have a pilot's license?
Yeah, I had a pilot's license. I took the training for a commercial pilot and for a pilot license and then a commercial pilot training.
All right. Now, Mr. Vinson, directing your attention to the events of November 22, 1963, which, as you know, is the day that President John F. Kennedy was assassinated, would you, first of all, tell us where you were stationed in the relevant time frame before November 22, 1963?
I was assigned to North American Air Defense Command in Colorado Springs. This was beginning of latter part of 1962 until 1965.
And was there a base there at which you were stationed?
Yes, I was stationed at Ant Air Force Base.
All right. Why don't you go ahead and tell us then, commencing at that point, about an experience which took place on November 22nd, 1963, but of course commenced prior to that date to lead up to November 22nd, 1963.
Well, prior to that, there had been some promotions made there on the base, and I kind of felt that I was entitled to one of them, and I didn't receive it. So then I requested a leave, and I went back to Washington, D.C.
And the purpose of that was to accomplish what?
Was to bring my personnel records before the Pentagon staff that was over the Armed Force or Air Force at that time, to show them that I had commendation medals, outstanding evaluations, and so forth, and to find out why I didn't receive one of those promotions at that time.
All right, so this was an effort to discover, as you said, why you hadn't received a promotion which you felt you deserved.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
All right. Now, at that time, where did you live?
I lived in Colorado Springs.
All right. Did you own a home there?
Yes.
You and your wife lived there?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Tell us about then the experience of going to Washington, D.C.
I went into Washington and obtained a motel, well, it was a hotel, fairly close to the Capitol so that I could walk back and forth. And the next morning I got up and went over to the Capitol to see the congressman from my area.
That was Congressman Jimmy Jones at that time?
Well, I had gone over to see the congressman from my home state, Alabama.
I see.
But they referred me to Jones, which was actually in charge of the Public Works Subcommittee, I believe it was. And he referred me to a Colonel Chapman, which was my understanding. He was the liaison officer between the Congress and the Pentagon. And I was sitting by his desk, and he called the Pentagon and made arrangements for me to go over and talk to them.
And where was his office located?
It was there in the Pentagon. I mean, there in the Congress hall, building.
All right.
It was downstairs, but I'm not exactly which floor it was on. I signed in Congressman Jones' office, and he looked at my, backing up, he looked at my records, and then he referred me to Colonel Chapman.
then you're still in Chapman's office?
While I was in Colonel Chapman's office, at the time it didn't mean too much to me, but he received a telephone call. And I only heard his side of the conversation. I couldn't hear who the other people on the other line, on the other end of the line. He told this party he was talking to, he said, we have information, and I strongly, highly recommend that the president do not go to Dallas. He says, of course, the advance party from the Congress here has already departed, but I still highly recommend that the president do not go to Dallas. Well, I just passed it off at that time, and he told me where to go catch the limousine to go to the Pentagon. And I left there and went downstairs, and it was a tunnel that I went into, and there was a limousine there, and he took me over to the Pentagon. I went into the personnel office over there, and I saw a master sergeant, and he looked over my records, and he said, well, I'd like for you to wait a minute and have a seat over there. Then I saw him go into the office of a colonel. I didn't get the colonel's name, but he went in there, and he was in there for approximately 15 to 20 minutes.
Terry, let me interrupt you there. Was this Colonel Chapman with you and in your presence all this time?
No, I was by myself at this time.
All right, well, I thought you referred to Chapman taking you to the Pentagon.
No, he made arrangements for me to go to the Pentagon.
All right, go ahead.
And then I waited there for about 15 to 20 minutes, and he came back out, and he told me, he said, he would like to see you, speaking to the colonel. And I went in, and he'd had my file there, and he started looking through it, and he says, are all of these like this through your career? And I said, yes, it is. He said, okay, we'll look into this, and we thank you for bringing it to our attention. So then I got up and went back outside, and about 15 minutes later, the sergeant came out and gave me my folder, which I had took with me, and told me that they would be in touch, and things would be taken care of.
Now, again, this is in reference to your promotion.
Mm-hmm. All right. All of this. And I left. He said, well, you can go on back now. So I left there and went back over to the hotel. I went out and had dinner to a nearby cafe close by there, and went home and called my wife that night and told her that I'd seen Mr. Jones and what happened. And then I told her I was going to go out to Andrews the next morning to catch a flight back to either Lowry or Colorado Springs.
And Andrews means
Andrews Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
The next morning I got up about 6:37, caught the bus, it takes you out there. I arrived at the base about Andrews Air Force Base about 7, I guess around 7:30.
And this would then be what date?
This would be Friday, November the 22nd.
All right, of 1963.
I walked into the terminal, and there was a long counter on the right-hand side, and I walked over to the airman there, and I asked him if he had any flights going to Lowry or Colorado Springs, either one. He said, no, we don't have any flights leaving here today. None booked out.
All right, let me ask you a question at this point. Had you made any previous arrangements to catch a flight back, or why did you just go to Andrews Air Force Base on an impromptu basis, more or less?
Normally, they have flights going out of there to different parts of the country. And usually, we would have a shuttle run between Colorado Springs, which is NORAD, and Andrews. It was one on Wednesday, and I believe one on Friday, and different dates.
We meaning the Air Force?
Yes.
All right.
Yeah, Air Force would have these flights to shuttle correspondents, personnel, dignitary personnel, and all to have flights going to these bases, since it was the command center for the North American Air Defense Command.
All right. Well, you as an enlisted person went then to Andrews without any prior reservation or arrangement because it was customary for Air Force personnel to do that, to travel around the country.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Please proceed.
I might have even caught one in, say, into Offutt Air Force Base, Nebraska. You could go in there, and anything going out that could carry passengers, you could get on if you thought it was close enough.
So you would not have to pay extra for that?
No.
So, in effect, you were kind of hitchhiking.
That's correct.
All right. Go ahead.
I was hitchhiking. And I walked over to the passenger terminal where the airman was and asked him if he had anything. He told me no. I said, well, he told me to sign in first. I signed the log sheet there. And I said, well, since I didn't have breakfast yet, I think I'll go in. There was a little cafeteria across the hall. And I'll go over here and have some breakfast. I went over there and I ordered my breakfast. And after that, about 15 to 20 minutes, she had just brought my breakfast in. I heard my name on the loudspeaker to report to the passenger terminal. I went over there and I figured they had something, and so I didn't finish my breakfast. I just went over there and I said, you got something going on? He said, yeah. You see the C-54 out there on the runway? I said, the third one down? He said, yes. He said, go get on that. It's going to Lowry Air Force Base.
And
Colorado Springs. I meant not Colorado Springs, but Lowry Air Force Base, Colorado. And since that was only 60 miles away, I thought, well, this is a good ride. So I
60 miles away from where?
From my home in Colorado Springs.
All right.
So I went out, and when I got out there, there was some steps in there already set up. And I saw one.
You mean to the entrance of the plane?
Yes.
All right.
And I saw one person walking around underneath it. Like he was inspecting, checking it out. But he didn't have a hat on, and I didn't see any insignias, just a pair of coveralls. And I went ahead and crawled in.
All right, pardon me just a moment. Could you tell us something about the configuration of the C-54 and any particular markings that you remember being on it?
There was... Well, the C-54 was a twin-engine cargo plane, which I had seen before, and it had, but the tail was a little bit different than what I was used to, and it had a marking on it that looked like a world, the picture of a world, without all the different drawings, just plain. And then it had longitude and latitude white marks around it.
And what was the background color of this?
It was a dark, well, it wasn't real dark brown, but a brown color.
All right.
But with white marks on it.
Did you see any other emblems or designations on the plane of any type?
No, which really it was a little bit, I guess I did notice, because normally most of the aircraft had USAF written on the tail. This one did not.
All right. Now, you referred to this as being a twin engine. The C-54 was a four-engine plane, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a four-engine.
All right. So you're correcting that?
Yes.
All right. So you could see no other designations or labels on the plane, and you proceeded to board?
Yes.
All right. Was anyone on the plane when you boarded?
No, there was no one.
All right. Then go ahead and tell us what happened after that.
Well, then another general, I was sitting down not too far from the door where you get on, the cargo doors. And there was another gentleman came up dressed in the same type coveralls, and but he didn't have a hat on either. And they both got on, and it surprised me. They never said a word to me. They just went on up to the cockpit.
All right. Now, these men were dressed in coveralls?
Coveralls.
With no emblems or designations?
Of rank or anything.
All right. And was that unusual for the Air Force?
To me, it was.
All right. And nothing was said to you when they got on the plane?
No, and that was unusual because normally the captain or whoever's flying the plane would say, hi, welcome aboard. We're going to Denver. Hope we got that nice weather. And they always had something to say to you.
All right. Were these two men carrying anything that you recollect when they boarded the plane?
No, they were. And most of the time, the pilots would have a small briefcase for the manifest and for the other aerial photos, you know, that they took with them.
All right. And now, these men were Caucasians, were they?
Yes, both of them were Caucasians.
All right. Go ahead and tell us then what happened after that.
Well, they went on up and closed the cockpit door behind them, and they revved up the engines. We taxied on out to the runway and took off. And we were headed toward Lowry Air Force Base,
all right,
or at least west.
What was the approximate time that you left Andrews Air Force Base?
It was between 8:30 and 9, around 8:30, I think.
That would be p.m.?
A.m.
A.m., all right. Go ahead.
We left there, and I assumed it was around 12:30 because he came over the loudspeaker and said that the president has been shot. It was shot at 12:29. He told the exact time and everything.
So this is what you heard over the...
Over the PA system in the aircraft.
All right.
Then he did a complete 180 and headed south.
A 180 means what for lay people?
Well, that would be a turn to the left, which we were headed west, be a turn to the left 180 degrees. And headed south.
So that would be a rather abrupt...
No, it was an abrupt turn.
All right.
And we went from I didn't know where we were going, but we just kept flying, and it wasn't, I guess, about 3:30 or 4 o'clock right in that area. I noticed a big city down below me, and after looking it over pretty well, I figured it out. It was Dallas, Texas. And not knowing whether, at the time, not knowing where the president was at, I didn't know he was in Dallas. I just, he just told me that the president was shot, you know, because I'd heard the colonel say, I highly recommend that he don't go to Dallas.
This is back when you were in Washington, D.C.
Right.
Right.
So I didn't know, you know, where he was there or not at the time. So we did a turn to the right, and then we made a turn back to the left and landed south of the major, south of the city of Dallas. The reason I know, I'd been there a lot of times, and I saw, you know, where they'd done construction and so forth along the highways there. I went to Houston a lot to see my grandsons. And we were there, or we stopped and we landed there and stopped for about 10 minutes. And during that time, two men came aboard.
All right, let us back up just a little bit. When you say your plane made a left turn of 180 degrees, actually, if the plane is flying west and makes an abrupt left turn, it would be a 90 degree turn, would it not?
Yes, you'll be correct.
A 90 degree turn?
Yes, it would be, correct me on that. It would
all
be
right.
A 90 degree.
All right. Then you say that you recognize the city as being Dallas. How did you recognize it as being Dallas?
Well, I'd been through Dallas a number of times, even during all the construction for Highway 45. And I'd been back before I went out 75 all the way through. And Dallas is... once you've been through there, it's you get a pretty good idea of what's landmarking.
All right.
The buildings, you can see them real plain from the highway.
All right. Now, go ahead and tell us again where or describe the area where this plane landed, this C-54.
It was south of Dallas along the Trinity River. We were on the south side of the Trinity River when we landed because there was trees and water back to the north of us.
All right, go ahead and tell us what happened after that.
And then there was two gentlemen got on the airplane. One of them was oh, about 6 foot, 6 foot two, weighed about, I imagine, 200 or around 190, 200 pounds. He was wearing white, well, it was a beige-like coveralls. And there was another gentleman, him, he was much shorter, and he had black hair, kind of skinny, and I guess he would weigh approximately maybe 150, 155 pounds.
All right, were these Caucasians?
One of them looked like he was Latin, maybe Cuban, and the other one was Caucasian.
All right. And were they both, these last two men you're describing, dressed in these beige coveralls?
Yes.
Any insignias or labels or anything on their coveralls?
Nothing other than a belt that tied in front here.
All right.
And it was a kind of beige color that they were wearing. The Jeep was a yellow type, looked like a road Jeep. They used on roads, you know, for repairing them. Yellow. It was kind of yellowish color.
So this vehicle was sitting there on this, what to you looked like a road under construction.
Well, it looked like where we had landed was a road under construction.
Yeah.
And the Jeep was back up, oh, maybe about 20 or 30 feet from the door when they got out.
All right.
And then they walked on up and got in. Jeep turned around, took off.
So there was another person who was driving the Jeep.
Driving the Jeep, right.
Who subsequently left.
Yes, all right. Left. Well, in other words, he backed up out of my sight. I couldn't see him anymore.
I see. All right, so did you recognize either of these individuals that got on the plane at this point?
No, I did not know either one of them.
All right. Did you later see some recognition of one of these persons that boarded the plane?
Yes, I didn't recognize the larger one, but I did, after seeing his picture on television an awful lot, a person that looked like him, and he looked, this person that got on the airplane looked an awful lot like Oswald.
All right. And but this came later after you saw Oswald's picture on the media.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. So then the plane turned around and took off?
Well, we turned around and took off and we're headed west.
Did anybody ever say anything to you up to this point?
They did not speak to me. They went on up behind the cockpit and sat out, and no one spoke to me, not even the pilot or... I might have been a navigator, I don't know, but... And one other thing that was interesting, that we didn't have a crew chief. Normally all Air Force flights carries a crew chief.
But in addition to the pilot and
right,
co-pilot?
And co-pilot.
All right. Now, where did the C-54 go?
We went to, I later found out, a place called Roswell Air Force Base in New Mexico.
All right. And we did... I'm sorry, go ahead.
When we landed there... It was about dusk. It was getting late in the evening. And when we landed there, they just taxied over to the side, came, all four of them came back to the back, opened the door, got out, and took off. Never said a word to me. You have to find your way home or whatever. They just all jumped out and took off. And then I got off and went over to a building that had a light in it. That's why I say it was dusk. It had a light in it, and... you could still see the outline of the building and all, but I went in there and there was an MP in there. AP, not MP.
I'm sorry, what's the difference?
One's air police and the other one's military police.
Thank you.
And I went in there and he told me, he said, I said, how can I get downtown or where am I? I first asked him, where am I at? He says, you're at Roswell Air Force Base in New Mexico. And I said, well... I guess this is as far as my ride's going. I'll have to go downtown and catch a bus home. How do you get there? He said, oh, you can't go anywhere. I said, what's the matter? He said, well, this base was placed under alert, full alert, and said nobody can leave or enter. And I said, well, we just landed. He said, well, I don't know anything about that. He said, but you can't leave until the alert's over.
So how long approximately did you have to wait?
I waited from then. It must have been, I would say, about 6 or after. I waited until 9 o'clock before he let me go. Then he told me where to go catch the bus downtown and catch the Greyhound to Colorado Springs.
Did this AP ever request identification from you?
No, he never did ask me anything.
All right. And no one else talked to you after the plane landed there at Roswell Air Force Base?
No, I didn't talk to anyone else.
Okay.
I did call my wife from payphone out near the gate. I'm not sure, I can't remember now where it was, outside the gate or inside. But I did call her and tell her where I was at after I found out.
All right, and so did you then subsequently catch a public bus and get transportation back home?
Yes, it was about 11 o'clock. They had a bus going to Colorado Springs. And I caught that bus, and I arrived in Colorado Springs the next morning about, must have been around 8 or 8:45.
All right. Now,
this was Saturday morning.
Mr. Vinson, what did you think about this experience at that point when you had arrived at home?
Well, at first, I thought, well, we were diverted, you know, a most unusual flight, but we were diverted for some reason or another, and I just didn't sort of passed it off for right then.
Did you tell your wife about your flight being diverted?
Oh, yes, I told her that over the telephone.
All right.
Because she thought I was coming into Lowry Air Force Base.
Next week on The End of Innocence, the JFK assassination, we will hear part 2 of Sergeant Robert Vinson's 1996 interview with Attorney James Johnston. He will describe in more detail the area where he says the plane landed that day in Dallas. We will also hear the remarkable story of what happened to Sergeant Vinson in the next few years of his military career, and why he didn't tell anyone about what he witnessed that day on November 22, 1963, until almost 30 years later. If you like what you hear every week and want to learn more about the assassination, please pick up my book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's available right now on Amazon, or you can find it at www.endofinnocencejfk.com. In honor of the 61st anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, I'm sending out signed copies of my book. If you would like one of these, please email me at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. The price is $40 for the soft cover and $60 for the hardcover, plus shipping and handling. I can promise you, you won't be disappointed in the book. It's an oversized coffee table style book. The book is over 500 pages with almost 1,000 pictures. You won't be disappointed. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. We'll see you next week.